Scott Tinker says he made the documentary film Switch to explore the best route to an energy transition, picking the technologies that are most viable in the long term for meeting a growing global demand for energy. Tinker is a geology professor at the University of Texas. In Switch, he travels the world to look at just about every energy technology you can imagine before choosing the ones he believes can serve people best in the decades to come. Tinker says his conclusions come without a political agenda. You can decide for yourself when Scott Tinker joins me today on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. There are a lot of folks advocating a lot of approaches when it comes to energy. But our guest today says he's aiming at a balanced approach that considers the world's energy and environmental needs and a real-world appraisal of what will actually work. Scott Tinker is a professor of geology and director of the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, as well as the State Geologist of Texas. And in the documentary movie Switch, which he made with Harry Lynch, Tinker travels the world to look at different energy technologies and concludes with his own proposals for the best mix of energy technology for the foreseeable future. And both the movie Switch and Scott Tinker will be at the University of Illinois Urbana campus tomorrow. There's a free showing tomorrow night at 7 p.m. with Scott Tinker in attendance at the Lincoln Hall Theater. It's a presentation of the Prairie Research Institute at the University of Illinois. Also earlier in the day, Professor Tinker gives a seminar on hydraulic fracturing, the role of shale gas in the U.S. energy future. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. at 103 Mumford Hall on the U of I campus. And Scott Tinker is our guest right now here on Focus. Professor Tinker, welcome to the program.
Oh, great. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Scott, you use the word switch to refer to a transition to a better, I guess, energy technology mix. Is there a common understanding that something new is needed, that the status quo is not going to do it?
I think not so much an understanding that that's happening or needed, but that it just has been happening and will continue to happen. We've seen a change in the energy mix going on for a century now, and a lot of that's driven by a variety of things, economics and efficiencies. And so we were really trying to examine what that continued transition looks like and what are some of the things that drive it and how quickly it can happen.
Well, before we go further, I just want to add that if you have a question for Scott Tinker about the world's energy needs and the best way to meet those needs, give a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Scott, in your movie Switch, you calculate let's see if I got the numbers right, that each of us use 20 million watt hours a year. And I guess as for purpose of discussion, you define that unit as a person. Essentially, how many people do we need energy for in the future? Tell me about how you came up with that amount. Is that a realistic amount, knowing that many millions of people right now use far less electricity?
Right. In fact, that's a global average, 20 million watt hours.
That's a global average if we take people who are totally off the grid plus super plugged-in people in America, et cetera?
Yeah, in fact, Americans use about 95 million watt-hours.
We're really pigs, aren't we?
Well, we certainly are industrialized. And if you look across the kind of the global industrialized nations, that average is, you know, much higher. It depends in part on distances drive. That adds a lot to it and other kinds of things. But, you know, you go right on to undeveloped nations or just early developing nations, and they're quite a bit lower than that. And the kinds of energy they use is very different as well. So it's a pretty complex system. But the main goal that we wanted to achieve there was twofold, was to get some unit that people who aren't energy experts can take and understand and compare different kinds of energy to one another using a standard unit of some kind. But also a little bit more subtly perhaps was to put things in human terms, to recognize that people are the only consumers of energy and that we each matter.
Okay, and I think one thing that you made clear in the film is that, you know, the energy usage isn't going down. There are growing middle classes in Asia, for instance, who would all like to live at the standard of living that we're living here in the West. So they're starting to use more and more energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, using Asia as an example, you know, you see 1.3 or 4 billion people in China, of course, but a similar number in India and growing. Close to a billion people in those two countries alone that have very little access to energy. So a billion people, that's three United States that don't have energy or much energy at all. And they are starting to grow and industrialize. So it's one of the big challenges. In fact, I just started showing this in some of the talks. If you look at a map of the world and put your finger right on about Bangkok, Thailand, in Southeast Asia, and draw a circle around it that goes into China but doesn't include all of China, and that same circle will lap into India but not all of India and come around in that part of Southeast Asia. You know, it's not a huge circle. It turns out more people live inside that circle in the world today than outside of that circle.
What are the countries in that circle doing now? How are they set in terms of increasing their energy production?
Well, they consume more energy in the aggregate than the rest of the world or any other big geopolitical part of the world because of the number of people. On a per capita basis, less. So as we've talked about, they are growing. If you look at the mix of energy inside that circle, it's right at about 50% coal. And that's not just electricity generation, that's all energy. So about half of the total energy is coal, which means if you add up all the coal production and consumption around the world, the rest of the world, it's less than inside that circle. And that's one of the great challenges. Coal is an affordable, available, and reliable source of energy, heat, to cook and boil water and make steam and turn a turbine and make electricity. But it also produces, of course, a lot of sulfur and nitrogen and carbon dioxide and mercury and other things with it. So it's one of the big challenges in the transition is how to think about changing from a carbon-based fuel, and coal is largely just carbon, into other forms.
That's one thing that struck me with your film is that you do take into account environmental questions. You seem to accept global warming formed by man-made energy outputs as something that is happening and something that has to be addressed.
Sure. You know, it's not a film about global warming. It's not a film about the environment. But these things are so woven together, energy and the environment and the economy are so woven together that it's a film about energy, and then we let the scale and the great access we got to facilities and the terrific people that we were able to visit with tell that story a little bit in different perspectives and in their own ways. Again, us not focused on it, it's enough to cover global energy in an hour and a half, but really, you know, again, those things tend to come out, and part of one of the great challenges, of course, is looking at emissions into the atmosphere.
Well, in the film, you consider all the possible energy production methods that I can think of, and you go to some really impressive facilities around the world illustrating each of them. When you started looking at this question, did you have any preconceived notions of what you thought you might come up with at the end of it?
Yeah. You know, we all bring our own biases, and I was born into and have been in the energy business my whole life, and so we all bring those biases to things. But I met Harry Lynch, who's the director of the film and a documentary filmmaker, and we agreed on a couple simple things, that we weren't going to pre-write the story, which is important. We filmed for 2 years in 11 countries, so we didn't have a pre-written script. We agreed we wouldn't make anybody look stupid and that we wouldn't pit somebody against somebody else, which is sort of, some documentaries kind of take that more active approach, and we, we weren't going to go down that road. So those are the three things we set off to do. And then to be as objective as we could, bringing my biases and his. But in doing that, the story kind of began to tell itself as we were filming and then for the year in post-production afterwards, and pre-screenings for documentary filmmakers and the public, and they'd fill out some different surveys we'd give them, and we learned a lot in the post-production process and tried to tell a story that's entertaining, but also objective, looking as much as we could at what's there today and some of the challenges as we go into the future without being too heavily biased.
And I'm wondering there then, as you went to your filming on location, where were you still undecided about the conclusion, or had you already done the research behind those locations?
Well, I've been in the energy my whole life, so I had certainly lots of experience in different things. But I'll tell you, some things that changed in my head across the several years were the impact of personal choices, the things that we can do in efficiency and becoming better in the way we understand and use energy. And then certainly the scale. You know, I understood it, but it really comes forward is when you're talking about 7 billion people, how do you provide that scale of reliable and affordable energy to people and still environmentally sustainable? It's that juncture there that is not simple. I think it's solvable, but there's not a one-size-fits-all. And that's what kind of has to come out and does in the actual facts and data.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about the future of energy with geologist Scott Tinker of the University of Texas at Austin. He lays out his thoughts about the subject in the documentary film Switch. You can see it tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Lincoln Hall Theater, and talk to Professor Tinker as well. And you can talk to him now. Call us at 333-9455. That's a local number, but feel free to go to our toll-free number at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Focus at Focus580. I'm going to do, first let me issue a spoiler alert that I'm going to talk about the conclusions of what you come up with as a possible menu for energy in the future, in the long term. One thing I wanted to make clear, because I'm actually a little fuzzy on it now as I ask you, when you come up with this menu of viable energy choices, were you thinking about on a global scale or, say, on a North American scale?
Definitely a global scale.
So that all things considered, that this would be where the largest use of energy would come from.
Yep.
Although you talked about facilities, when I'm thinking of those hydroelectric facilities in Norway, you know, it seemed pretty clear that you have them. It's a good idea to use them.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, that we have a little moniker, you know, you use what you have where you have it. That really drives the mix. If you have hydro in Norway, absolutely. You know, the topography and rainfall, and they use that. Iceland uses geothermal. Some countries have tremendous solar intensity and can use that, or wind. Others have great fossil fuel resources, and they're very affordable and reliable for them. The challenge, of course, is to make sure we continue to make them more environmentally sustainable in that long transition. So it's a global look. I call it a description of the future, not a prescription for the future.
Well, by the time you reach the end of the movie, and please correct me here if I have the details wrong, you're proposing a combination of a reliance on natural gas, much more so than now, nuclear energy following the French model, which includes a recycling of spent nuclear fuel, so there's a lot less spent nuclear fuel that you have to store, and renewable energy sources such as wind and solar power.
Those are the three that grow. Yes, they do. And coal decreases proportionally. Oil decreases proportionally. Again, these are in percentage terms as a mix of the global energy. And those natural gas grows and nuclear grows and renewable energies grow.
And in percentage terms, which could mean that coal and oil production could actually increase in whole numbers.
In fact, they do for a while longer. Most population experts forecast a plateau somewhere around 10 billion people. And the combination of adding 3 more billion people to the planet, which we do about every 13 years, we add about 1 billion every 13 years now. And industrialization and growth of developing nations pull on energy. They pull that demand. Now, industrialized nations are flat today and, in fact, decreasing a little bit on a per capita basis, which is good. And hopefully some of those technologies continue to improve with efficiency and we drive that energy consumption on a per-person basis down so that we don't see the same levels of growth that we've seen historically.
And I should say the last few minutes of your film talk about conservation. It doesn't look like radical conservation, but it just talks about what sounds like the common sense sort of things we're always told to do, but maybe we don't get them
done. Yeah, in fact, as I said, I didn't even necessarily think that me, 1 out of 7 billion people, mattered as we went into filming several years ago, but started along the way of putting in light bulbs and then insulation and doing things in my home, and we finally bought an electric golf cart, and the director heard that. He goes, why'd you do that? I said, well, we looked at a lot of our local mileage, and a lot of us right around the house, we can get there in a golf cart. So he said, well, we got to film this, and so... You know, what I learned, I'm not a filmmaker, but what I learned throughout the process is how you conclude a film is really where you, if you can only leave your viewers with one main thought, it's often what they see last. So we spent several minutes coming back to the individual, talking about personal choices and efficiency, and then recognizing those translate to businesses and industries and our kids and the way we live our lives. So that's really the cultural switch, and that's the big switch that is occurring and needs to continue to occur.
It's conservation. Okay. Also, more natural gas. Why the emphasis on natural gas, and why so much more of it?
Well, there's been a decarbonization, Jesse Ossabell's term, for over a century, from carbon, which is coal, to hydrocarbons, oil, a lot of carbon and some hydrogen, to a lot of hydrogen, a little bit of carbon, which is methane. Methane is natural gas, 1 carbon and 4 hydrogen. This has been going on in the energy mix, mostly for efficiency reasons and abundance reasons. And then from that, perhaps down the road to a non-carbon-based economy at all, some hydrogen economy and other kinds of renewable sources. So, you know, what you see is a natural progression into natural gas. There's a lot of it. It's affordable. It's reliable. It's available. It's less CO2 intensive than burning coal or oil. So there's a.
Is it as easy to get out of the ground as coal or oil?
Well, in fact, it's easier. Natural gas flows easier than liquids in rocks and certainly solids you have to physically mine. They all still require extraction, subsurface extraction like all extractive industries. So, you know, for a long time, natural gas was produced associated with oil from oil and gas well bores. It still is produced on its own. When it's found in shale, like liquids, you have to crack the rock or fracture the rock in order to get it to flow. It flows easier than liquids, but it's still, the rocks have to be cracked because the rocks are, you know, you could slab those things, polish them up, and put them on your countertop and cut cheese. So, you know, it's tight rocks for sure.
Well, in terms of fracking to get gas out of shale, mm-hmm. How much of the extra additional gas production we're looking at will require fracking, and what are the environmental questions around that sort of production?
Sure. No, it's a big topic today and an important one. If you think about shale, which we geologists do a lot, it's the most common sedimentary rock in the world, more than other kinds of things. So it has a lot of organic material in it when it's deposited. The environment and the organics rot and die and become hydrocarbons. So it is the source rock where the oil and gas are formed. When you go down there now and drill into that shale, and they drill a horizontal well bore a mile or more laterally and crack the rock. Natural gas and liquids flow into that well bore and flow up the vertical well. So the process of hydraulic fracturing, putting high-pressured fluids into the earth at depth, and I think it's important to emphasize those depths, has been going on for a long time, almost 60 years now. It's been going on in oil and gas basins. The bigger challenge, of course, now is that drilling is being done in places where it hasn't been done before, so they don't have necessarily the system set up to regulate it well yet. And it's going on in a large number of wells because it takes a lot of wells to produce natural gas and oil from shale. It doesn't flow as easily, so it takes more wells. So the number and the location have increased the public awareness that this is going on. The fracking itself, the actual process of going down in the earth and cracking those rocks, has not been shown yet, ever, to have cracked rock all the way to the surface of the earth, contrary to some things you might read or see. It violates some physics to do that. Now, if you were to frack real close to the surface of the earth, it could, but down 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 feet, not. What does happen, however, is you produce those fluids, water from the shale, salt water and gas and oil, up the pipe, and just like any oil and gas well, that goes past the aquifers that are near the surface of the earth. So those aquifers have to be protected by cementing the casing against the rock. And that's done very well, almost always. On occasion, it's not done well. And that gas or those liquids can leak into the aquifer around the wellbore, and has. Again, not very often, but it's a local problem. It has to be, the well needs to be shut in. The operator who does that, who, if they have a record of doing that, should be not allowed to operate. I mean, it's just a simple thing in my mind, is if you don't follow your permits and the regulations, you don't get to operate. Other things that can go on at the surface, when you're handling a lot of fluid at the surface, like trucks that can have accidents, on occasion they do, you produce these fluids into a holding tank, and that on occasion can leak, and has. Again, these are pretty rare occurrences, but they do happen. And so all the surface handling of these things, just like always has gone on in conventional oil and gas wells, needs to be done very well. I think that it continues to get better and can be even better than it is.
Do you think it can be better on a global scale that all countries and all governments are committed to being that careful about the use of hydraulic fracturing?
Yeah, great question. And
then doing the repairs and changes when problems happen.
Sure. You know, I think that there are some countries in the world where conventional oil and gas have been produced that don't do it as well as the U.S. Or some other nations. And that's been going on for a long time. They need to. And, you know, the real challenge, Jim, is this, and I think it kind of comes forward in the film, is if you don't want to, natural gas is used to make electricity. It's used in heating and cooling directly in your homes. You might have a natural gas stove, you heat your hot water, et cetera. It's a very versatile fuel. And you can put it in vehicles now, you know, compressed natural gas vehicles. So it's a very versatile fuel. If you don't want to use it or like the hydraulic fracturing risk-reward scenario, you have to ask yourself, and this is where I think we don't do a good job, what are the options? And, you know, for electricity generation, there are three big fuel options: natural gas, coal, and nuclear. We are growing our renewable portfolios, and they're growing on a percentage basis very quickly, but they're still a very small part, and they can't provide a baseload, and by that I mean a steady production of electricity because of the challenges of wind not blowing and the sun not shining, and we don't store energy. So, you know, if you don't like fracking, then you got to think about nuclear and coal. And I say this, I lecture a lot around the world, and you look at you look at folks and say it, and I'm not always the most popular guy in the room, when I say, hey, you know, it's okay not to like fracking, but do you like nuclear or coal then? And quite often people don't like any of those. And so then you have to say, well, all right, do you use electricity? And I don't mean that facetiously. I mean that sincerely. We use so much electricity, and that is how it's generated.
One last question about fracking before we go to the break.
Sure.
And, you know, actually, and we'll take a call in it right after the break. I want to make sure that our caller stays with us. Just before we went on the air live this morning, I was hearing on the BBC's Business Daily broadcast the former president of Shell Oil, John Hofmeister, talking about fracking and its potential for natural gas, but also talking about its use of water and him saying, at least, that there are parts of the world, and I think he mentioned China as one, where they have a lot of natural gas in shale, but not that much water for use in hydraulic fracturing.
Yeah, yeah. John's a good friend. He wrote a great book, Why We Hate the Oil Companies.
It's a good title, yes.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a good read. I think he's very objective. And so hydraulic fracturing does use a lot of water. In a relative sense, not as much, near, even close to things like agriculture and industry. But it does use a lot when you think about on a sort of a millions of gallons basis. We've run the numbers here in Texas, a big state, a pretty dry state. Hydraulic fracturing today, and it's very active here in Texas, uses about the same amount of water as watering all the golf courses in Texas, because it takes a lot of water to water those. And this is, you know, it's not trivial. So changes that are being made, operators are now starting to use the water that's produced from the shale, the old ocean water, salty water, for fracking. Produce it, recycle it, and reuse it. That's going on in the Marcellus Shale. It's not enough water. You still have to add some, but it reduces the amount quite a bit, and it uses the produced water to go back down into the rocks where it came from. That's a great advance. People are starting to look at ways to reduce liquid use substantially, so going toward other kinds of liquids or even potential for other kinds of ways to crack the rock that don't involve water necessarily. Those are further out there, but some interesting work's being done along those in that regard. And of course, one of the other good advances is the chemicals that are put in the water, and it's about 1% of the total. Still not a trivial number. So if you have a 3 million gallon frac, that's 30,000 gallons of additives, and it reduces friction, and it keeps it's a biocide to keep things, molds from growing, etc. People looking at ways to change the chemical mix to things that are a lot more inert, if you will, and still accomplish the same task. So, you know, I think that it's important to recognize that, you know, we're all kind of in the world together, and we're all trying to, I think, accomplish many similar things in partly in different ways, but there are good changes that are being made, and they need to continue to be made.
Well, we will continue this discussion and bring in our caller for a question about fracking in just a moment, with more talk about our energy future with Scott Tinker here on Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus with Scott Tinker, a professor of subsurface geology at the University of Texas at Austin, and the maker, along with Harry Lynch, of the documentary film Switch, which aims to write out a prescription for the world's future energy needs. Professor Tinker will be on hand for a showing of Switch tomorrow night at 7 at the Lincoln Hall Theater on the U of I Urbana campus. Admission is free. He's also giving a seminar tomorrow at 2 p.m. at 103 Mumford Hall on what we're talking about right now, the role of shale gas in the U.S. energy future. But he also believes that it's a good part of the global energy future, part of the prescription for the future, as outlined in his documentary movie, Switch. Let's go ahead and say hello to Harriet on line one. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. There's so many people in our state who are glad that you are here, Mr. Tinker, Dr. Tinker, to present your film. At this time, we are in the process, citizens, of responding to rules for fracking in Illinois from the Department of natural resources. Our state government passed a very strict set of regulations for fracking in Illinois, but since then, our Department of Natural Resources has loosened them quite a bit. And I was wondering if you have been informed of this and if possibly you would be willing to discuss that during your talks tomorrow or tomorrow night.
You know, I've heard that those regulations were passed and have been being discussed. I haven't read them, so I'll confess that I'm not up to speed on your particular group of regulations or several states that are doing different things. I'm happy to discuss anything tomorrow night in terms of what I have seen and understand from lots of states and works that I've done and been around looking at different regulations as they come to pass, and some of the ones that I think make great sense and others that might not make as much sense, depending on, again, local geology and some of the regulatory setting. But I'm happy, you know, I'm not elected, so I'm happy to talk about anything.
our state legislature, for once, did something quite responsible in passing this law. And now the State Department of Natural Resources has reduced it, and it would be of concern because of some of the dangers that you've just discussed, like the wells leaking or things like that, and the chemicals that are actually used and so on. Well, I just wanted to alert your listening audience that our state DNR has reduced those regulations, and perhaps more people will be interested in taking a look.
Okay, Harriet, thank you very much for calling in. And before we get to run out of too much time, I want to go on to the next form of energy you had on the menu, and that was nuclear energy. And no one ever seems to have problems with the idea of nuclear energy as being able to produce a lot of energy. It's just questions about safety which always come up. And your movie does talk about, for instance, what happened to the nuclear reactors in Japan that were damaged by earthquake. But you use a model. You use France as what you see as a model of well handled nuclear energy. Can you talk more about that?
France made a commitment to nuclear many years ago because they didn't have options. We talked about options earlier. They didn't really have access to coal or natural gas for power gen. They committed to nuclear. They get 80% of the electricity from nuclear now. About 52 reactors in France, just because folks usually don't know this, that's about half the number of reactors that the U.S. has. We have about 103 or 4. And one of the things they also committed to was trying to reprocess and reuse the nuclear waste. Again, this was driven mostly out of economic reasons. They didn't have access to affordable raw uranium like we do here. So the reprocessing and reuse was partly driven out of necessity. And they do it very well. They have a very large, the world's largest reprocessing facility there at La Hague. So they bring in spent fuel from around Europe and even a little farther on trains and trucks and boats. They reprocess it and re-enrich the uranium and send it back out for use again, and then take the few percent, 4 to 5% of fission products and silicify or vitrify those and store them in these cylinders, these metal cylinders, right now in 30-foot thick concrete. But they've actually approved now and permitted a geologic repository, so hollowing out shale in this case and putting those canisters there. They haven't started that yet, I don't think, but that's coming.
Are they having a resistance? I mean, there was supposed to be a geologic depository in the U.S., but it's essentially, I think they've essentially given up on the idea.
Well, they have. At Yucca Mountain, at least politically, it was untenable. Harry Reid was trying to get reelected in Nevada, and that wasn't going to work for him if that was going forward. So politics came in, and the geologic repository in the U.S. was at least put on hold. At least the one that we'd spent several $1 billion creating. France is, I'm sure there are folks that are concerned about that. You know, I think that's one of the great advantages of democratic governments. You know, everybody can listen to and weigh in on, and you move things forward slowly. one of the great challenges of reprocessing here is lots of folks don't want the waste moved across their districts on trucks or trains. So it stays at the reactors here in spent, you know, in pond, in the pools, and also in dry cask. And that may not be so bad. It's still an energy source down the road that could be reprocessed. But it is, you know, it is stored where it is created today at the reactor site. So that is certainly, you know, use of the waste, reuse of the spent fuel, reduction in volume and intensity is accomplished there, which is nice. Lower volume, lower intensity. That's one of the challenges of nuclear for sure. And of course, the other one being the risk of proliferation of plutonium. It's not weapons grade, but it's closer to weapons grade, and people are concerned about that.
And that's why we don't have much nuclear energy in Iran yet, because of that fight going on there.
That's the big concern, is that when you go down that road of actually getting close to weapons grade nuclear material that can be created and made into weapons grade material, and yeah, that's certainly a viable concern. So now, in terms of actual safety numbers, just the raw numbers of producing a kilowatt hour of electricity with nuclear, it has been the safest of all.
That's considering Chernobyl, considering Three Mile Island, considering Japan.
Yep. Those are the three big ones, and no human deaths in Three Mile Island. It was, you know, it was an accident that could have happened but didn't. Chernobyl was an accident that happened massively. And Japan is ongoing. Very few deaths from the actual radiation. I think none so far. Three from the facility collapse during the tidal wave, the tsunami. But the potential for increased cancer, and people have run those numbers, the increased likelihood of cancer from the radiation in the area. Considering all of that, the numbers are still quite low relative to known emissions from coal and particulate matter and that kind of thing, and, you know, et cetera. So it again, it gets to those, how do you generate a whole lot of electricity at scale that is always on, if you will, or baseload? There are choices that need to be made and mixes that are there and exist. And
What you seem to be saying is that, as frightening as this is, and I should say that the Japan nuclear accident from the earthquake was so frightening that I think at least one other country, wasn't it Germany, had made the decision to essentially get out of nuclear energy.
Germany did. In fact, it's an interesting story, Jim. I think it's one that's fascinating to me. Germany put a moratorium on hydraulic fracturing, and then followed closely Fukushima, and so they have, at least currently, moratoria on nuclear, although that's on the bubble right now. As a result, Germany now takes physical delivery of coal from the Powder River Basin in the United States on trains to barges across the ocean, on diesel-burning barges, on trains to Germany where it is burned to generate electricity, along with their lignite. And lignite is the same kind of low-grade coal we have in Texas. It's the worst, not the good stuff you have there in Illinois, you know, the high-heat coal. So the CO2 emissions in Germany have been rising the last 4 years in a row.
So maybe the devil they know rather than the devil they don't? Is how some people maybe, some governments may be reacting to this?
Coal is affordable, available, and reliable, and it's the only other baseload option if you don't do nuclear or natural gas. So whereas the CO2 emissions in the United States have come down to 1992 levels because natural gas has been replacing coal in power plants, Germany's have gone up. And so, again, if you're worried about global warming and CO2 in the atmosphere, nuclear produces zero emissions, natural gas half of coal, and so there you have some of the challenges and trade-offs. It's not always what you think.
Well, part of the question also seems to be of how well plants and facilities are run and maintained. As regards to fracking, we received an email from Alan, and he writes regarding cement casing when drilling wells. I'm going to mispronounce this name, Anthony Ingrafia, an industry insider, estimates that up to 20% of wells drilled have a, quote, bad cement job. If there are 50,000 wells drilled in a state, that's 10,000 wells. In Allen's words, that seems like a lot to me. That brings up just the question of the quality of work that goes into any facility of any type of energy technology, and how can you ensure quality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so currently, that's a very large number. I'm not sure.
You think the 20% of wells being bad cement jobs is not credible to you?
It's very high. That would be very high. And again, because we go back a century drilling oil and gas wells in the United States and around the world. The first one was 1859 in Pennsylvania. Now, certainly historically, the cement casing bonding that to the rock wasn't done as well. There's a lot of things we did historically that weren't done as well as we know how to do now, not just in energy. There are now ways to test the cement bond. It's called the cement bond log to see if it's got good integrity. States regulate that pretty carefully. Their regulators don't want groundwater polluted. I mean, we have to kind of get away from the conspiracy theories a little bit and ask ourselves, what are the goals? And the regulators want to protect groundwater as much as anyone else. The oil and gas companies want to be allowed to operate, and so they try to do as good a job as they can. They're not trying to go out there and wreck the environment. Now, they are trying to make money. Mm-hmm. And so regulations have to be in place with certain standards that are required. I'm actually in favor of cementing all known producing horizons in a well bore, even not just in the groundwater. It costs more money, but it would, you know, add more protection to the potential for leaking. At the end of the day, we all pay for that energy, and those prices get passed through to us. So it's not something that's going to keep prices as low as they have been. We have to recognize that. And I think that so the consumer needs to say, what are you willing to pay for? You know, the irony, you go back to the Germany case, is Germany wanted affordable electricity still. So they're burning more coal. It's what we say and what we do aren't always the same thing. We have to recognize our own actions and what we drive for as well. And the cost of energy seems to be something that people, from individuals all the way through industries, want to keep pretty low. We're used to it.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions about energy for geology professor Scott Tinker, who outlines his energy proposals in the documentary film Switch. Our number is 1-800-222-9455. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Along with these older forms of energy, relatively older, of natural gas and nuclear energy, you say there is a role for renewable energy, specifically solar and wind power. Here in the U.S., these energy forms are a really small part of the picture. They're still subsidized by the government, and they're hampered by the battery technology we have at this point today. But you think they have a future?
Yes, I think they have a great future. The challenge with solar and wind is really one of density. The sun comes down to Earth, and there's a lot of energy that comes from the sun, but it's dispersed. The wind blows in places, and it's terrific, intermittent, but excellent. And again, though, in terms of energy density, wind blowing can only create so much motion. So our challenge is to take these lower density forms of heat and motion and convert them into something that's high density, like electricity, things we want to use. It takes a lot of land to do that, and it takes and because it takes a lot of land and infrastructure, it's expensive, not real efficient. So you're converting a certain amount of the sun to usable energy, and they call that a capacity factor or efficiency, if you will. If you combine night with clouds and other kinds of things, it ends up being in the plus or minus 10% range for solar. And people will say, no, it's higher than that. And I agree, on a good sunny day, you get good conversion efficiency. But if you throw everything in, the total installed solar and what's actually generated, around 10%. Wind is higher, around 20%. So these things cost money, and that's one of the great challenges. You have to back them up because we use electricity in real time. An electron is generated and it's used instantly, travels at the speed of light. So when the wind stops blowing for a little while, we have to have something else going so that we don't have rolling brownouts or the lights don't come on and off intermittently. And those are generators like natural gas, coal, and nuclear.
So that's why you do have this mix of older and newer technologies.
Yes.
Yep. Now, I assume that if there were a breakthrough in battery technology, that would change the equation.
Changes the world. You know, if you, any students listening or other folks, if you want to change the world of energy and really in many ways change the world, crack the nut of storage. And by that I mean affordable, scalable, and reliable. Those things have to come together. But if we could get affordable, large-scale, reliable storage of energy, whether it's electrons or heat or other forms, that changes the world. Because now I can remove the intermittency, store it, and use it when needed. And that, you know, again, I'll say my description, not prescription for the future, has renewables growing more quickly than anything, but it's out there pretty far still. And that's just based on my current knowledge and understanding of where we are in large-scale energy storage. If that moves closer to the present, then renewables accelerate more quickly.
Among renewable energy options, you don't seem to be that bullish on biomass fuels.
Mixed on it. I think biomass, ironically, biomass being the kinds of things that we burn today, mostly for heat and cooking, it's still a several percentage globally, like 7 or 8%, mostly in undeveloped nations that are burning wood chips, dung, and feeding hay. If you look at a biofuel, though, something that can create a liquid to put into a vehicle, you have corn ethanol there, not a particularly energy-efficient form. But we looked at a lot of the cellulosics in the film, went to both nice climates in the south and temperate climates up in New York, looking at some of the things going on to create liquids, liquid hydrocarbons from carbohydrates or plants. And again, you're doing what nature did. You know, geologic time and burial created liquid hydrocarbons from plants. That's what happens when oils formed. But time was the big factor. So what we're doing and trying to do today is accelerate that through a chemical conversion process.
I think there's some research here at the University of Illinois along those lines.
Absolutely.
With plants like switchgrass, et cetera.
Absolutely.
But apparently they haven't cracked the nut on that one yet.
They're getting there. I mean, the challenge is scale. They know how to do it. The real big challenge is how to, again, low density, because you're growing these plants now over lots of land, and you got to collect them, transport them to a conversion facility, and then liquefy them. So if you move them too far, Jim, you know, if you move them too far, you're using more energy to move them than they're going to create.
You've downplayed the use of coal to a large degree because of the pollution question, and that brings up a question that Jim has emailed to us, and which there's some research going on here in Illinois, and that's carbon sequestration.
Yeah.
Can it help?
Yeah, Illinois is doing some great things there, and we work closely with them. I have a large carbon sequestration team here at the Bureau where my day job is, and it certainly can help. In simple terms, I think we can physically put carbon dioxide back into the rocks today. A lot of good federally and industrially supported research has shown that you can put it back in the rocks. Can probably do it at scale, physically. The challenge, of course, again, is cost. How do you get it out of the stacks, either scrubbing it out of what's there today or building facilities that will do that more efficiently in the future? The cost of doing that and then moving it and compressing it and injecting it and storing it and monitoring it is a lot. So you're going to add 50% to 100% in real terms to the cost of your electricity, depending on what form of fuel you use. So that's the big challenge with it, but I think we're starting to look at places where that can be done most affordably and really trying to go to the next level of injection and see if we can put tens of millions to hundreds of millions of tons of CO2 back into the earth instead of into the atmosphere.
Okay. Well, we're out of time right now, but I'm sure you're welcome to continue the discussion with Professor Scott Tinker of the University of Texas at Austin, because he is on campus tomorrow on the University of Illinois campus for a 7 p.m. showing of his documentary film Switch at the University of Illinois Lincoln Hall Theater. He'll also be giving a seminar on natural gas fracturing from shale at 2 p.m. at 103 Mumford Hall. Professor Tinker, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks. I enjoyed it very much and look forward to seeing folks tomorrow.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Sari Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Tomorrow on Focus, the potential of urban farming with Will Allen. Allen founded Growing Power, an urban agriculture program in Milwaukee, and he says bringing farming from the countryside to the inner city can improve the quality of city life. U of I Crop Sciences professor Sam Wortman will join us, too, to talk about the potential and challenges of urban agriculture. That's on Tuesday's program. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.